This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn. I'm Chua Eun Teck. My guest today is lawyer Fong Ching Leong, and he's here to talk us through a series of court rulings in the past year which dealt with the ubiquity of Facebook in our lives. Among the cases were defamation on Facebook, using Facebook comments to prove adultery, and how a chat history on Facebook Messenger saved an alleged drug trafficker from the death penalty. Can we start with defamation? How is it defined on social media?
Well, there is no separate definition for defamation on social media. So if there's a defamation, normally, generally is defined as lowering the reputation of a person in the eyes of the public.
And there are at least three cases in the past year that you've highlighted in your blog. What were the unique points in those cases?
One of them is the Maricel case, for short. Basically, the plaintiff was a former maid of the first and second defendant, and then they sued the defendant for defamation. However, on the application defendants, the High Court struck out the plaintiff's claim against the defendant on the ground that the statements were honest, based on facts, and raised during a proceeding at the Labour Office at Kuala Lumpur, and has protected by absolute privilege and immunity from an action for defamation.
Basically, the maid sued the employers for saying that the employers defame her.
Yes. In fact, there's actually more facts to this case, but the case is quite long. The plaintiff, after she left the employment of the first and second defendant, she actually married a local person. And then after that, they had a disagreement from there. So there were publication. There was a complaint by the first second defendant about the conduct of the plaintiff when she was under employment. So, based on that statement, that's why the plaintiff said, you know, what you mentioned is all defamatory against me.
So that's and why. Was it all because of a Facebook post, and the maid was not satisfied with that?
Yes, basically, all stemmed from the Facebook posting. All started from there.
And was it absolute privilege? Well, what's that principle?
So basically, absolute privilege is a privilege granted to a person when you're in a certain, let's say, in location. So for example, in court, you say something which is defamatory, but you are protected from absolute privilege. But if you say that defamatory word outside the court, you will be subject to a defamation action. Likewise, for example, in parliament, you can say something which is defamatory of a person, but you were from that, because of absolute privilege, you are protected from being sued, or actually, in some cases, you from being charged as well. Unless there is another case, which is Nurul Izzah's case, which she was charged for sedition, for saying something seditious at parliament. So there's some little exception in parliament.
And can I just ask, what's the reason for this privilege? Because if I'm an employer of a maid, and I know for a fact that the maid has a poor track record in terms of her working habits or work ethics, why would it be wrong for me to reveal it on Facebook?
Oh, well, you can actually reveal. You can actually make a statement so long as it's a fact. So what she's disputing now, what you have mentioned, is not a fact. It's something defamatory. But sometimes a fact can be defamatory. But if it's defamatory, sometimes it is also protected. You are protected by this defense called justification. So long as it's the truth, it is nothing. You will not be liable for defamation.
A fact can be defamatory.
Yes. So because the definition of defamation is lowering the person's reputation in the eyes of the public. So therefore, if you say the fact is lowering a person's eyes, you know, lowering the person's reputation in the eyes of a public, it becomes you fall within that definition. So, but to counter against that is where all your defenses come in: absolute privilege, qualified privilege, justification, and so on and so forth.
Those are the various defenses against defamation.
Correct.
And so the conclusion of that judgment is?
There is no defamation in that case.
Okay.
Because basically what is discussed is it was from a Labour Office proceeding and based on facts.
Okay. And the second case?
Well, second case is called Wedding Galore against Rashida Ahmad. This case is, I think, it will help a lot of photographers. Basically, in this case, the defendants published pictures of the plaintiff without getting permission. So she was granted damages first. The photographer was granted damages of 10,000 ringgit. And the court also granted a public apology, which is quite rare. Normally in copyright cases or trademark cases, the court normally don't grant public apology. Normally they grant you an injunction or damages.
What but is an injunction?
Injunction is basically an order to stop you from doing something. So stop you from, one, publishing the picture again. Two is to remove the pictures from being published again. So he, in this case, the court granted the injunction plus a public apology. The damages was 10,000 ringgit. So this can be some form of a benchmark to a lot of photographers who find that pictures, you know, the pictures being taken without getting permission or pay of a license fee.
Is this the first time that this infringement has been found to be illegal?
It has always been illegal if you take someone's photographs or someone's copyright materials without permission and paying any monetary sum. It is unlawful. Basically, it's an infringement of the Copyright Act.
But these are posted on Facebook. So who does that image belong to?
The image, regardless of where it was published, online or Facebook or Twitter or wherever, the ownership belongs to the author normally. Normally, when you take a picture of a wedding shoot, the ownership resides in the photographer. But if you have engaged the photographer, let's say I engage a photographer, by way of operation of law, once I engage the person, I pay the person, the copyright will belong to me, the person who commissioned the work. Unless it's in writing that the copyright belongs to the photographer, if that's the case. So when you go for, this is quite important because let's say you hire a photographer, for your wedding shoot, always look at the terms and conditions because the terms and conditions will sometimes say the photographer is the owner of the copyright of the pictures. So basically he has the rights to your pictures, notwithstanding that your face is there. So he can actually go and sell the pictures if he wants to without getting your permission.
Is that a common clause in wedding photographers?
It is a very common clause in a lot of photographers, actually. Mm. In fact, in the US, I once engaged a photographer there. They actually own the copyright of the photos. So I have to choose what photos I want and the rest will belong to him. If I want the copyright to the pictures, I will need to pay extra for it.
In essence, if it's a picture of you and the copyright belongs to the photographer and you use that picture for commercial purposes, that photographer can come and sue you later on.
Correct. So, but a lot of times the photographer also, what they do is they take the standard terms and conditions. They say, well, this is standard, taken from somewhere, another photographer, without understanding the full consequences of the clause. Sometimes what they want to do is actually to take the pictures for the promotional materials, for the little booklet, for the website, for basically just to promote their services more. So if their intention is to do that, they can always have an additional clause, have an under clause in their terms and condition to say that we have the right, notwithstanding that you are the owner of the copyright, we have the right to republish this picture in, let's say, promotional booklets and our website.
Correct me if I'm wrong, this picture that was taken is a picture in her likeness. So if the picture on the Facebook account is a picture of a landscape, a view of Kuala Lumpur, for example, how would you prove ownership? Would that still be illegal to use?
Oh, if let's say someone has taken a picture without your permission, if you cannot detect any identical reproduction, then of course you will not have a case. But if you find that the picture is, assuming that you are a professional photographer, one, you watermark it. Two is you will put something what we call a copyright trap. For example, in maps, you will realize that in some maps, there actually are some roads which doesn't exist. So if the road does not exist, basically it's an indication, it's a marker to say that this belongs to this person. If you find it, the same road in another map, which the person claims to be his own map, there's actually an infringement of copyright. So it's basically a trap to indicate that this is the source. So let's say your scenario is in Facebook, it's very difficult to prove if I do not have something called a causal link. Mm-hmm. Causal link is me and you have some form of link. But if a guy lifts it up from your website and he deletes all watermark, especially if you're talking about a landscape accessible to everyone, then it will be more difficult to prove. that is actually a reproduction of your picture.
So crediting the author or have a citation, that doesn't help at all?
If you use it on a commercial sense, let's say your commercial body or your basically if you're a company, you use someone's picture and even if you credit it, it is still not good. You still it still amount to copyright infringement because there is the defense, what we call a fair dealing or it's a fair use, does not apply for when you use it for a commercial purpose.
I'm speaking today to lawyer Fong Ching Leong about the law and Facebook. We'll talk more about what happens to our online profiles once we pass on after this short break. BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. Good afternoon. I'm Chua En Tik. Lawyer Fong Ching Leong is my guest today, and we're talking about how the law increasingly has to deal with how Facebook is used by us. Coming back to defamation, this thing that the fact can be defamatory is quite troubling to me. When you call people names on Facebook, are you opening up yourself to a lawsuit?
You can always insult a person. You know, freedom of speech. Say good things. You can always say bad things. So you can always insult a person. You can always call a person names. Calling them fat or ugly and so on and so forth. But you cannot again say words like, for example, this person is a criminal. If you say person is a criminal and he's been, let's say you add the word, this person is criminal. He's been convicted of a crime. Let's say cheating, that is defamatory because that fact has never happened. So, but then if you call, you cannot call a person a con man. A con man also, but also amount. There are cases that amount to defamation. So, but you can always call people names, for example, based on their appearance, the physical look of their face and physical look of the body. But to call them of a certain character, that may cause trouble to you.
So a criminal accusation would be defamatory.
Normally, a criminal accusation would be quite clear-cut defamatory.
Can you then claim it's a joke? Maybe you lost at poker and then you say, that guy's a con man, he cheated me of my betting, so for example.
Well, it is... intention is... In proving defamatory intention is not relevant. It again is to prove that the statement has lowered down the person's reputation. But if people have read it, have thinking this is just a joke, anyone understanding the background, let's say these two are very good friends and best friends and all whatever they mentioned in the past, they're basically joking with each other, friendly bantering, like they call it. So sometimes the court will take this into account and say this may not be defamatory. Or two, in terms of damages that's been granted for defamation, it could be lower.
So in what instances would a fact be defamatory? Like if the person was convicted for stealing, for example, when would saying that on Facebook be defamatory?
If you say this person is a criminal and he's been convicted of this crime, if you follow the definition, it's defamatory. But of course, qualification that it becomes defamatory is taken away because it is justified because it's a fact.
Moving on to another case. A woman used a conversation thread in the comments section of Facebook to prove that her husband is having an affair. Has this happened before?
Well, this is the first case that I read. That wife wanted to prove that the husband went on holiday with another woman in Bali, in this case. So to prove that these two individuals had gone for a trip to Bali, she used Facebook posting to prove it. So the Facebook posting of the lady who went to Bali. In that case, they use the Facebook posting together with the comments of the other users there. Unfortunately, this kind of evidence is not enough to support evidence of adultery because adultery is beyond reasonable doubt. It's not your civil litigation. Civil litigation is on the standard of probabilities. So, and persons who mentions there, who mentioned the comment there, they are not giving a testimonial in court. They are basically an outsider. And they are not in court giving the evidence. And basically, those other users are basically hearsay evidence. So in that case, it is not strong enough to prove adultery.
Can you just clarify the difference between beyond reasonable doubt and balance of probability?
Well, if I put in very layman terms, beyond reasonable doubt, basically there's no doubt that this has happened. Whereas for balance of probabilities, probably this has happened. So if I put it on on a very, on a percentage scale, maybe at about 51%, or, you know.
And 51% is enough.
I think it's very dangerous to put in that, and in percentage wise, I think on a standard of a balance of probabilities, probably this has happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in this case, it was about adultery.
Yes.
And balance of probability is not yet the standard of proof.
No. Because one thing, the reason why is adultery beyond reasonable doubt is because it also amounts to criminal offence.
And so this woman's lawyer was using a novel technique in trying to argue the case? Or has this been used before?
Well, using screenshots and chats and things from the public domain nowadays, online public domain, is a very common thing nowadays. You know, if you go to court nowadays, you prove a lot of things through your chat logs and your screenshots and so on and so forth. And court, if the court had the and moving in times, the court will need to accept all this evidence as, you know, all these screenshots and all these chat logs as evidence in the future, because the way we conduct our lives right now is through a lot of instant messaging and, you know, postings.
Because that's what the judge who wrote the ruling said, right? That probably in the near future, there has to be a realignment of how cases like these are
correct.
Assessed.
So our law of evidence has to be somehow updated on the admissibility of electronic evidence, you know, WhatsApp and chats and emails and all those things. There must be, you know, one, there could be, what we can possibly do is, you know, one rule or a few rules to govern the evidence for electronic evidence. So currently we have Evidence Act under the Section 90A, which provides for electronic evidence. So normally nowadays, if you go to court, if it's printed from computer, the court normally will admit it because it is public. It is printed from computer. There's therefore, you know, electronic evidence. Therefore, we can admit it. So it becomes very some courts will say that, you know, I want the maker, you know, want the person who make this document to come over in court. So the standard differs in court. Some judges take a very lenient approach in admitting electronic evidence. Some judges take very strict approach in admitting electronic evidence.
In what instances then would something like this, a Facebook comment or a screen cap of a post, be usable or be admissible as evidence?
If you look at civil cases, for example, normally the maker, let's say for example, there's a defamatory action, and then I obtain a screenshot of a certain, you know, a statement. I want to sue that person who made a statement against me. I will need to print out that statement and give it to court. So, but if assuming that, you know, before I could actually read the statement, someone actually deleted it, and then but the third party comes in, actually I made a screenshot for you already. That person, assuming that, you know, person who make it, says that I never said it before. That person actually has to come to court and say that I made this screenshot, this is a screenshot. And then he has to come and testify, I saw this myself. Whereas for the criminal action as well, likewise, the person will need to come and say, I made this screenshot, this is my screenshot. Unless that person does not dispute, I actually made that screenshot, I made that statement.
So it can be easily bypassed, and as long as the person comes and shows up in court, then
I'm the maker of this screenshot.
Yeah.
And therefore, this is my
and then statement. It can be admissible.
Normally, the maker will come and admit the statement. But from the experience, the person who makes the screenshot, normally, if they do not want to come to court from experience because they do not want to get liable or don't want to get, you know, a repercussion for appearing in court. Right. So that is always the problem.
So always screen cap.
Yes.
A wrong.
Yes. In fact, we spend a lot of time nowadays is to make screenshots of cases of let's say Facebook postings, websites, and we spend a long time compiling evidence just to give it to court. And after that, once we make it or PDF files, for example, we need to print it out and then, you know, submit to court.
In that case, the lawyer, i.e. yourself, would be the maker because you were the person who screenshot. Yeah.
So that is also becomes tricky. Because you will go to court and say the court will judge the trial, they will ask who make the, you know, screenshots, and then they'll say my lawyer did it, and then your lawyer will be stuck because you may be conflicted out. You are a potential witness as a lawyer, you may be disqualified from acting from a client. So the best way for a lawyer to avoid any trouble is ask the client to make the screenshots themselves.
Okay. chat histories then, would that be a more straightforward way to support a case in court?
Chat history nowadays is highly used in court nowadays, especially WhatsApp chat messages or WeChat messages, so on and so forth. So the method of reproducing them in court also is where it differs from court to court. Easiest way is, of course, you know, there's a printout the chat log button, and then you save it, and then it comes up with a text file, and then you put it in court. But that one, you do not have the, what do you call it, the screenshots of the pictures that's been sent or the voice messages has been sent. So you will only have text. So which is insufficient, because if you have a discussion, you would exchange any other stuff as well, voice sometimes and pictures sometimes. So the other alternative is to make screenshots, you know, of the, you know, the chat log itself. So you have, let's say, a month of chat logs, you print out lah, screenshot, one whole back PDF file. So the one case which I did, we had about what 200, at least 200 pages of screenshots of the chats. But the only issue is I will have problem extracting the audio. I would extract the audio and then make a transcription of audio and submit in court. So in court, we still rely on the way we present evidence is still primitive, still by way of paper. So we cannot go to court and, you know, it would be useful if we go to court and all I need is press the button and play the video or play the audio. So, but in court, sometimes in trial, I can't do it. But you know, when it comes to exchange of affidavit, which is by hard copy, there's no system for me to go to court and play the video in court for the court to see. In fact, I heard of one case, because it's a video, it's by way of affidavit evidence, you know, by hard copy document. The lawyer just annexes the CD into the affidavit, because nowadays all court now is all documents must be e-filed. So what they do is they scan the CD and they upload it into the system. So in the court file, you can actually see the CD there, but not the file itself.
Right. Just to show that the file is there and can be accessed.
So our current system is not up to date, in other words.
And is it easy to forge a chat log or text messages or email exchange? I ask because the case that you highlighted in your blog is concerning a woman who was saved from the death penalty in a drug trafficking case because of a Yahoo chat log, and she was able to show that she was an innocent carrier. Mm. And there was another case involving a German national, this time with the Facebook Messenger chat log. Mm. And he was first able to prove that he was an innocent carrier, but the Court of Appeal later reversed that decision. Mm. Chat logs, how crucial, how important is it? Is it easy to forge?
Chat logs is very easy to forge. Actually, there are websites which can generate chat logs for you. In fact, if you know the, assuming that it's a screenshot of, as I said, either by text or by screenshots of chats, if you know the font of the chat logs, you can easily manipulate the wordings there. So when it comes to that, then you will need an expert to look at it. Some expert can be able, for example, the chat log, it is in, let's say, a screenshot. You can actually see whether the text has been manipulated or not. You know, the color of the color of the surrounding background, the font, the size of the font, the date of the change of the, you know, the data, the metadata in the file. So there are a lot of things you can actually look into to determine this, whether this file has been tampered or not. And again, unfortunately, our system, current court system, we do not have the system to access the metadata of evidence. So you want to see whether this data has been manipulated or not, so on and so forth. You need to still present it in a hard copy manner. So if any of your forensic tests must come with a report. So sometimes the parties, the lawyers especially, if sometimes they are not well versed with electronic evidence, they do not look into the evidence inside, the further evidence in the file, to determine whether this file has been tampered or not. So chat logs, likewise, if assuming that someone puts in a chat log, and I allege that this is fraud and it's been tampered, the person who alleged it, has to prove that this is, you know, has been tampered.
Right. It's more complicated than an email exchange, for example.
Yes, likewise.
Okay. So I think more and more of our conversations or daily life involves electronics. would you recommend that all of us archive our chats instead of deleting them?
Yes, in fact, we should be storing and back up all our chat logs every day.
With every single person.
Every single person should, especially those who do business, they need to store it properly and archive it properly and have a backup for it. The reason I'm saying this is because recently I had one case where there was a conversation between two parties, but that conversation has gone because his phone broke down. His phone broke down and we do not have that evidence anymore. So I cannot prove whether that he has said this conversation happened or not. So it becomes a disadvantage for us. But in another case, it was useful for the chat logs helped the client because those evidence, he kept everything. We could use whatever chats he had with his, the other party, and we can use it against the other party. So if possible, save up as much chat logs as you can and backup it through cloud and so on and so forth.
Can a person's chat log or chat history be used to prove or demonstrate a certain personality trait? I'm thinking in this instance of rape cases, for example.
Well, it could happen. Chat logs, I think, assuming that, let's say, is a rape going on, rape case, let's say the perpetrator, the rapist, had the, conversation with this victim. So the chat logs between them would be helpful in proving, there was a relationship between the parties. And after that, the chat between them, it will also be useful. Or he had communicated with, let's say, another person. Or let's say, a lot of times what they do is investigate, look at your search browser, your search history. If you are, let's say, for example, this rapist, by way of drug the lady. So he will, sometimes they will check your search logs, whether you have searched for certain drugs, a date rape drugs, for example. Right. So they will go through every part of your life, of your electronic evidence, to prove that you have done so and so, or you have done this act which led to the rape.
But can you ask Google, for example, to give this kind of information, or Facebook? Because you search a lot of things on Facebook as well.
Yes, indeed, if you... it's possible if you subpoena Facebook for the evidence, probably they will give you. It is very common for us to actually subpoena or initiate action against Facebook to provide information of certain users, IP address, date of login, what activities, and so on and so forth.
And there's no way that person, the account holder, can stop this?
No. Normally, the account holder would not be alerted that you are being investigated or your data is being accessed. Because assuming that it is a serious case, let's say a rape case, once they've been alerted, this guy will just take flight and go, disappear.
Okay.
So normally Facebook will be your gatekeeper of your information.
Right now, we have ownership over the posts and the images that we post on Facebook, our texts and emails, our tweets as well. But once someone passes away, what happens to the ownership of this digital archive or digital estate?
By default, the operators of your accounts, like say Google, Facebook, even Amazon and even eBay, by default, they will not grant access to anyone else. So let's say for Facebook, which is quite common, is once you pass away, your page, what we call is memorized page. So the person... you will no longer have access, assuming that, once they connect, you can actually log in for it. Once the page becomes like that, you can no longer access to it, or you can also not look at the chat history and so on and so forth, all be gone. So basically, your page should say, this person passed away and so on and so forth. So there are cases where the next of kin of the Facebook holder wants to access the data. There are cases where they want to access the email, access the chat messages, and so on and so forth. Most of the time, these people will not grant. The account operators, Facebook, Google, everybody, they will not grant you access. unless you have given written authorization. But now with Facebook, because of this issue, they have actually a new function where you can actually authorize a person to take over your account or access your account after your death. So there's a function in Facebook. You just need to enable it, and then you put that person, another Facebook user, to be able to access your account upon your death. So you don't need to go through the
before it becomes memorialized.
Yes, before you passed away, you need to do it. So basically, instead of your will, you also need to do additional steps for your account, your digital accounts. You actually put in a will, but in a will it's going to take months. You know, once you get your will, let's say passed on, you need to go to trial court, get your will sealed, and so on and so forth. So you get a grant of probate and assuming that you will. If you don't have a will, then you have to go and get a letter of administration. So there's a complicated process if you passed away, and most of the time, the person who draft your will would not have taken account of your digital assets, and you know, copyright in your pictures, the access to your Facebook, access to your emails, and so on and so forth. So before, you need to take an additional step to access to, let's say, in Facebook page to enable that function, the administration function for your next of kin.
This is going to become a bigger and bigger issue, isn't it? Because more and more people are going to be leaving behind that digital.
Correct. In those accounts, you can actually have an option, elect not to give access to your next of kin. So if you say that, you know, you just want to pass on without giving out this information, you just want to bring it to your you know, your coffin, then you can have an option of not giving it.
Final message for us to how to take control of our digital footprint after death?
Well, I think we have to do it before you die, before your death. One is to determine what digital assets you have first. Your accounts, your email accounts, what email accounts you have, your online accounts, credit cards, bank, online banking, your apps, what are the things that you want to bring into your, you know, to your grave, or what are the things that you want your loved ones to have access. So one important part is, which I always think about, is the pictures, you know, pictures of your family. You save in a Dropbox, you save into Google Pictures. So how do you want your loved ones to access it? Assuming that, you know, you can always, you can think about, I'm going to just leave the computer there, and, you know, they can actually download from the computer. So but what then it got me thinking, what if you die in a horrible death in the house, you know, with the picture, and the house burned down, and everything is gone, hard copy. So the only access you have is through, let's say, Dropbox. So you need to make arrangement on how your loved ones will be able to access your digital, you know, in this case, your pictures, the family pictures after your death. Because now we look at the family album, there's no longer any hard copy family album, there's only digital copies of your family album. So you need to think of, you know, how in 100 years time, in my case, in 100 years, how is my, you know, grandchildren going to be able to access all these things? So, and in fact, I don't think there's actually a solution to that yet. In fact, if you look a bit further, 1,000 years later, if people, the archaeologists going through our going through the ground, they cannot find any traces of us because everything is in hard copy and everything is in soft copy and in electronic form, and it has been corrupted, you know, by time. So, but on that part, yes, you elect what you should give to your loved ones. Don't wait for later. You have to do it now. And also do it more bit frequently, maybe quarterly one time. And yes, and always do a backup of your digital assets.
Chairman, thank you very much. You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.